Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to Bristol Crime Fest. I'm Peter Guttridge, and I'm delighted to be hosting this event with one of our very special guests, Andrew Taylor. I'm not going to introduce him much because you've read the brochure and you know what a great writer he is. He's multi-award winning, prodigiously prolific, and we're going to chat for a bit, and then you're going to be able to ask him questions, and then he's going to be signing, I hope, vast quantities of his books afterwards. Can you just welcome formally Andrew Taylor? Andrew, tell me about the new book, or the latest book, rather.
The latest book is called Bleeding Heart Square, and it began with my grandmother when I was about 12, when she first told me about the family murder. When I say the family murder, I should explain it. Our link, the family link with it, was fairly marginal, but it had seriously registered with her when she was a child in the 1890s. Her grandfather was a farmer near Saffron Walden, and they had this lovely farmhouse, Georgian farmhouse, with a moat around it. And then, when she was a child, she would stay there with her sister, and she had these sort of lovely, idyllic summer memories of the garden and the moat. And then the grandfather died in about 1898, and the farm was sold to a man called Dougal, and a woman who was referred to as his wife, but was in fact a spinster called Miss Holland, who was rather older than he was. And Miss Holland had the misfortune to have a bit of money. And Samuel Dougal was a really unpleasant con man who had a way with women. And in the end, he murdered her. And he buried her in a ditch leading down to the moat. And for 4 years, he lived the life of Riley. He had a wonderful time at this farm, using Miss Holland's money. And what betrayed him in the end was not really that anyone thought he killed anybody, but because he couldn't restrain his philandering. He was there's no other word, sex mad, I think. he sort of went his lecherous way right through the village, right through all the locality. At one time he was sleeping with two sisters and their mother at the same time. Now, the problem here was, I think, probably not so much the sleeping with these people as the inevitable results. And there were all the paternity suits rather than suites.
Probably suites as well.
Suites is another sort of way to look at this. All the paternity suits, and gradually people began to wonder what had happened to the other women, and what in particular had happened to the unfortunate Miss Holland. And in the end, of course, the police moved in. They found the forgeries first, because he'd been forging the checks. Once they'd done that, they were fairly clear that he must have killed Miss Holland somehow, and that somewhere on the farm they would find the body. It took them 4 weeks of hard digging, and they drained the moat and everything, but in the end they found it in this one ditch. The body was almost completely unidentifiable, except for her shoes, which had been custom made, so that's how they knew it was her. The irony is, if he'd had any sense, he would have left her in the farm midden, and in 4 years, all the acids in that would have left practically nothing, maybe the odd thigh bone or something, which might have been the thigh bone of some sort of non-human animal very easily. So he missed a trick there. He could have actually escaped scot-free. That was one starting point. I've been rather long-winded on that.
A fairly major one, though, by the sounds of it.
Well, it's one of those ideas that sort of lodged in the mind, you know, that it never quite went away. And then in the 1980s, I came across a murder compilation, famous Victorian murder cases, that sort of thing. And I'd never looked up this particular murder case, even though I was then writing crime stories. of my own.
So that wasn't an inspiration, excuse me for interrupting this, but so that wasn't an inspiration
only
for your
on
crime?
A subliminal way, Peter. Subliminal, you know. We writers have a lot of that, as you know. But I happened to open this book and suddenly there were photographs of this murder case. There was the moat, there was the house, there was the murderer, and there was the victim, first in life, this really sweet-faced, middle-aged woman, very, very gentle, soft face. And there she was too, in death, as a mummy in the greenhouse at the farm, wrapped in ropes and sacking. And it was that contrast between the sweet-faced, live, middle-aged woman and this sad object on the chairs in the greenhouse that made me think there's a story there and I want to write it sometime. And 20 years later, I jolly well did.
But so why was it 20 years later and not then?
Because
I mean, I know you've been fairly busy, but...
It needed more to it, that it needed something else. And in the end, I found it with the fascists, the British fascist movement. There's a museum near where I live in the Forest of Dean, which is it's called the Museum of True Crime, something like that. It's in a very old jail. It's a very, very strange museum, and I do wonder about the psychology of the people who run it. But one of the major displays is about fascism. This chap's got very short hair and very big muscles, I should say. I'm a bit scared of him. And it's about fascism in the UK and in Germany as well. But this was the first time I'd actually seen things like fascist uniforms, our fascist uniforms, fascist marching drums, fascist cigarette lighters and fascist knuckle dusters. And suddenly you began to realise that this sort of thing wasn't something that had happened in Berlin or Rome. It had also happened here in England, on the streets of London, on other major city streets here. And that made me want to know more about it. And the more I read, the more I realised that in the early days, in the early sort of 1930s, fascism in this country was a very, very serious and credible force. And until about 1934, it would have been perfectly possible for us to have slid gradually into becoming a fascist state too. And I found that thought so utterly terrifying. And also, so, I don't know, worrying about if it could happen then, couldn't it happen now? And sometimes looking around you... in our Western world, you can almost begin to see things moving in that way.
Yeah.
So I thought, I want to write about that. I want to write about fascism in this country when it was respectable. And the third thing was my publisher entertained me to lunch at Bleeding Heart Yard in London, which is this really weird corner of London near Holborn with lots of legends attached to it. Very nice restaurants too. But one of the legends is about a great dance at a medieval house that was once there. And a tall, dark, handsome stranger came to the dance, and he found a young married woman who was very bored with the old, tiresome husband. And she danced all night with the handsome stranger. And at midnight, he danced, he was faster and faster, and they were getting very, 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 very hot. And he danced her out of the house altogether. And in the morning, at dawn, she was found on the cobbles of Bleeding Heart Yard. And she'd been cut open, and her heart was lying still bleeding on the cobbles. And I thought, I want to use that. I want that. And so that's... Once I had those three elements,
yeah.
I couldn't see how to combine them, but I knew I had a novel there.
Yeah.
I had a title, too, you know, Bleeding Heart Square. As I changed that, rather,
sure.
Rather than yard, I thought I'd use square.
And is that the way it's always worked for you, that there have been a range of inspirations that can emerge together, or have sometimes your novel, because you've written so many, have sometimes your novels been more directed and you knew exactly what you wanted to do from one single idea?
I wish I did. Wouldn't it be lovely? Wouldn't it really be lovely if you could wake up one morning and think, my God, I'm going to write a novel and chapter one will be like that, chapter one... We'll move on to chapter two, which will be like that. Some people maybe are like that, are they, do you think? Are there people who wake up with a novel fully formed in their head?
I think so, but I'm... So you're not, from what you're
saying
there?
No, what I need before I start is usually about three ideas. And an idea can be anything. It can be a title, sort of a title that sets your mind tingling, like a line of poetry sometimes can do.
Yeah.
Or it can be something like my granny's family murder. Or it can be something like the fascists, or some sort of idea I want to explore. You know, that with the Roth trilogy, I was interested in the idea that religious ideas of evil and good aren't the same as secular ones, and they sort of, they overlap, but they're not the same, and what happens when they diverge, and that sort of thing. I wanted to explore that. So it's something very, very nebulous, some sort of almost quasi-philosophical area that I want to delve into, not to find answers, only to sort of say, wow, I don't understand this.
And then what, the characters kind of came along next, or not necessarily, or you can't really say how it's quite hard.
I mean, because it's according to the nature of the original ideas. It may just, usually I get a setting, some sort of a setting fairly early on, and that helps.
Yeah.
Often there'll be a situation, an opening chapter or something, an opening few pages. I remember with my first novel, I didn't know how to write novels at all, and believe me, I still don't, but I read a book that said it was a very good idea if you didn't know how to write a novel, if you started with a corpse, because once you had a corpse, honestly, this is a very good tip, I pass it on to you for all it's worth. If you don't know what to do with your novel, if you don't know how to start it, or indeed how to go on, have a corpse, because once you've got a corpse, any corpse will do, you immediately have to start asking, who is it? Why is it there? Is it foul play? If so, who did it? And why? What's going to happen next? How did the corpse reach there? Do you see what I mean? Right away, it begins to make a story emerge.
Yeah.
So with the first novel, I just had the corpse. I had a corpse in the first paragraph and just went on from there. It's true, honestly.
No, I believe you.
Corpses are good. You know,
and the character is called Dougal, of course, which you...
That's an odd coincidence. In the first novel, the central character is somebody called William Dougal, who eventually becomes a sort of private investigator, a very amateur one, and he's the sort who commits murders as often as he solves them. But I must have known the name Dougal. It must have sunk deep into the unconscious mind. We writers have unconscious minds, you know, that we plumb occasionally, don't we?
We certainly.
You never know what you may haul out of them, and out came this idea of.
I do find it hard to anybody deciding to write crime who had a family murder, who didn't immediately mine it. I find that really strange, and especially as this name Dougal does crop up in your first novel and in.
I think I'm unplugged. Am I unplugged?
I think you're still working.
I'm still connected. Sure.
I mean, that didn't occur to you when you started writing crime fiction?
I think it's one of the many mysteries of crime, of writing crime fiction. Yes, you would think, wouldn't you?
Yeah.
It seems so amazingly obvious. You know, you've got something here in the family.
Yeah.
Grab it and run with it for all it's worth. Particularly if you want to write a crime novel. I can see your point entirely, but no. I mean, all I can plead is utter stupidity, I think.
But did you know the story back in those days, or did
yes.
you actually explore it more when
well,
you were doing
I mean,
the book?
I knew the basic outline of the story since I was 12 years old. I didn't know the details. But when I began to look for the details, I was really lucky because there was an account of the case from the 1920s. Mm. Which was a very, very full account, with lots of maps and things like that, so I could really fill in the gaps with that.
And did that feel weird, researching essentially a part of your family history?
Yeah, and that there was the names of family members I knew in other contexts were there, selling the farm and so on. And the farm labourers at the farm had worked for my great whatever it was, grandpa, all that sort of thing. There was all these sort of weird sense that... Yeah. In fact, my wife and I went to the farm while we were researching the book, and it is now one of those homes you would die for, in the sense that it looks incredibly plush and lovely. You know, they've smartened it up terribly. There's a swimming pool and a tennis court and all that sort of stuff, and there's a farmyard that's all been cleaned out and sanitized, and lots of 4x4s in it. But even though it's outwardly so perfect, it's still very, very remote, and it's stuck in this incredibly flat, bleak, anonymous countryside. And you feel anyone could scream there and no one would hear. We both felt, this is a very sinister place, I don't want to go back here.
Yeah.
We actually saw the spot where Dougal shot Miss Holland by the moat. It was chilling, yeah. Believe me.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So can we go back a bit to your... you grew up in Ely.
Yeah,
In Cambridgeshire. And then you went to Cambridge, which wasn't far down the road. Most students want to kind of get as far away from their family as they can. Do you mind my asking why you
went?
No,
I mean, I went to boarding school in Suffolk. I didn't just grow up in Ely, so I had been away from Cambridgeshire once or twice. But I suppose, I don't know, a lot of members of my family have been there.
Right.
And it seemed the natural place to apply to aspire to, I suppose.
Yeah.
My sister was there, and I thought, if she can go there, I can go there too, you know.
And were you a crime reader in those days? Or I mean, I think you did English, didn't you? Or were you rather more literary-minded?
No, I read a lot of crime right from the start. My father was a great crime reader, so there were always crime novels around the house, the Penguin Green ones, and Victor Gallant's Yellow Jackets, that sort of thing. So they were always there, and we all read all of the time anyway, so naturally you sort of hoovered them up.
Yeah. And were you thinking about being a writer, or did you indeed write when you went to Cambridge?
I wanted to be a writer since I was about 12. It was largely because it seemed a very easy way to make your living. You know, how stupid can you get, really? But I thought all you had to do was you remained at home. You could just write. And you sent off these things, and money came back. And in the fullness of time, you got extremely rich, and you wouldn't have to wear a tie to work. And it just seemed like the dream job. And also, at school, I was fairly good at writing little stories, so I knew I could do that.
Yeah. And influences back then, can you remember? I mean, who were you reading? Who were you,
when I was 12.
To be? Yeah, who were you aping when you were writing these stories?
I was reading Agatha Christie, Conan Doyle, a lot of Conan Doyle.
Yeah.
Woodhouse, reading. I began with Woodhouse very early. He's a deep influence, I think, Woodhouse. Marvelous writer. I don't know, all the usual ones, really.
Yeah.
William books. I love the William books.
They're just Williams.
Do you know those, the William books? The prose is just peerless.
Yeah.
She wrote a wonderful English.
And so you went to university, and were you trying to write novels then, or did you indeed write novels at university?
Alas, no. I wrote poetry. Sorry. I wrote songs occasionally, and I wrote... a journal. I kept a journal, a very serious journal. I thought, if I'm going to be a writer, I better keep a journal. I get used to writing, the practice of writing. So I got leather-bound notebooks and nice fountain pens and things. And I confide my thoughts about the universe, which were usually sort of the usual adolescent whinges. You know, it's extraordinary. All adolescent journals are much the same. They're just one long whinge about me. And mine was no exception.
Oh, you still got them?
I took them all down to the council dump about 12 years ago, and I felt I had a whole crate full of them. You know, amazing, really. 10 wasted years of my life in that box, and I took them down to the dump and I chucked them in. And I thought, I'm free now. I'm free. It was great. It was a wonderful moment.
You didn't see it as material, because given that you are mostly a historical writer in different senses, you didn't see it as material for what was going on at the time?
To an extent. I mean, I remember when I wrote a book set in 1970 once, and I'm pretty sure I read some of the 1970 volumes, 1970 to 1973, sort of that area.
Yeah.
Then.
But they were painful to read as well, because you seemed so gauche or whatever.
They were so painful and so self-indulgent and so self-regarding.
And the poetry?
I burned all that long ago. Also, there was the thought, you know, if I left it, one day the children might read it, and it would be so embarrassing. It really would be. I mean, they'd see what feet of clay I really had. I mean, I think they suspected, actually, but they don't actually know yet. But if they read the journals, they'd be poor.
But you know, we all hate writers, famous writers who've burnt their books or insisted that after they die, everything gets destroyed.
I think all novels are concealed autobiography, aren't they, really? So, you know, they're all...
So it's all in there.
I'm sure it's all there somewhere.
So just go, if you don't mind me carrying kind of chronologically. So you left university. I gather you travelled for a bit? You travelled went around?
Yeah.
Because this was late 60s, early 70s?
Early 70s, by
so
then.
What, you did a kind of hippie trail?
Yeah, or? I did all that, yes. All the sort of things you do on the hippie trail.
But still writing poetry? Or
in my and my journal. I kept my journal.
And your journal, yes.
Yeah. Where to find really good peanut butter in Kathmandu and other things like that, you know. It was all about that.
But still intending that you wanted to be a writer, or not really clear what you wanted
to
be?
No, it's clear. I wanted to be a writer, but I just didn't know how to do
it. And you were doing music, presumably, if you were writing songs before. Were you?
Well, just sort of playing around, you know.
Yeah, we'll come back to the music, because you told me something a bit earlier. We'll come back to that in a bit. But so you were doing all that. So then what? You then decided you needed a proper job.
Yeah. And it's very hard to get a proper job. It took me ages. I mean, I didn't try that hard. I signed on for a while when I got back, and I thought, well, this isn't actually much fun. So I got a range of things. I was a wages clerk and a boat builder and a labourer and things like that, and a teacher for a while. That was very difficult. They put me in... I was a supply teacher, and they put me in a secondary modern school for girls, and they didn't quite know what to do with me, so they gave me the remedial class. It's the hardest job I've ever had. And in the end, I realised the only thing I could try and do was let them treat me as an equal. It was the simplest way. And so we'd have long, I call them lessons. We had lessons about the I Ching and you know, things like that, things that would interest them and me rather than classwork. But it was really chilling stuff. I'm terrified of large adolescent girls, aren't you?
I am, actually, yes. Well, let's talk about you, not me. and then, at what stage did you then think, actually, I want to write a crime novel? What was the...
It's quite late on. I mean, I began to realise that I was reading a lot of crime. And I was doing some reading for a publisher by then, via a friend I knew. So I was beginning to meet publishers socially a little bit.
You're in London, or...?
Yes, by then I was up in London. Yeah. And I was learning that if you wrote a novel, if you wrote a crime novel, you had more chance, on the whole, of finding a publisher, more chance of making a little bit of money than if you wrote a literary novel. And It was also the fact I actually liked... I really, really like writing the sort of novel that people want to read. I didn't want to write a literary novel because I'd done my journals. They were the literary bit of me, you know? And I knew how self-indulgent they were. I wanted to write something that would actually, hopefully, make people want to turn the pages.
Yeah.
And I knew crime novels would make you do that because it made me do that. So, and then I read a Highsmith novel, and the world changed for me, really. But before that, I began work in a library, a public library. And the trouble with that job was I actually quite liked it. You know, you were working, you had lots of new books there. I liked the people I was working
with. And you're on the desk and back
behind as well.
Yeah,
yeah, all over the place. Yeah. And I was working in Harlesden, northwest London, fairly sort of tough area. And you never knew quite what or who would come through the doors. It was very lively. You had a lot of fun, nice music around there as well. Lots of reggae in those days, you know. Wild.
I lived in Halton. I thought you came through your door.
Wow! Good Lord.
I didn't have dreadlocks, though. But anyway, carry on. Yeah.
Anyway, it was very nice, and I actually got to the point one February lunchtime. Some of you, I'm afraid, almost certainly have heard this story before, but it is true. At least I can say that. One February lunchtime, I realised if I didn't do something now, if I didn't write a novel now, I didn't start this very, very moment, I could be here forever. And it'd be quite a nice job. It'd be a sensible thing to do. Real pension, real paid holidays, all that sort of stuff. And I knew I had to try. And so that lunchtime, I seized a biro, a sheet of paper, and I began to write what became the first chapter of the first novel. I knew the title, Caroline Minuscule, which was a medieval script, by the way, not a reference to a nearest and dearest of mine. And I knew the fact I wanted to have a hero who was a bit like Ripley in the Highsmith novels.
Right, yeah.
Someone who could kill if necessary. And I knew I wanted to make him quite nice. And the other thing, of course, I knew I had to have was a body, because if you had a body, you had a story. So, and that's what I had.
And the corpse, yeah.
And it just rolled on from there.
Yeah. And were you, I mean, that was very successful, and you won the award for the debut, it wasn't the debut dagger, John Creasy.
Yeah.
In that. I mean, were you able to then work right full-time, or did you have to keep up the jobs for,
well,
for
I was really, really stupid, actually. Looking back on my past self, I think, why didn't I try and work part-time or keep the job going right in the evenings? But I was offered £250 by Victor Gallance for the book. 250, even in those days, it wasn't a great vote of confidence. But I thought, right, this is wonderful. I'll leave the job and become a writer. And so that's what I did. Luckily, Caroline, my wife, was working in PR, which she hated, but she earned fairly good money at it. So we had no kids there,
yeah,
no mortgage, so we could manage.
Yeah. And is that why you were so prolific, or in fact were you just busting to get things out?
It's like Anthony Burgess once said, you know, I wrote much because I was paid little. It's as simple as that. That if you're trying to make a living, if you've got no other means of support, you have to get the stuff out somehow.
Yeah.
And I think too, when you start writing, and when you're relatively youthful, when you have all that physical energy. But also, when you start writing, it's as if you're opening the sluice gates, and a great flood of water comes out, a flood of all this sort of, all these ideas and thoughts you've been hoarding for years and years and years, and suddenly you can actually get them out and shove them on the page in black and white. So to that extent, it's easier. This is one of the great ironies of writing fiction, I think, that when you start, you know nothing about the craft of it, and in many ways you write very bad books because of it, but you've got all the ideas, you've got all the raw material there. But as you write more, the books become more polished, you know what you're doing far more. But you have to really fight to get the ideas out. It's strange. It's a real sad irony,
yeah.
Unless you're a genius, of course, in which case you don't have either problem.
So, I mean, so where were you at? Once you'd done sort of six or seven of the Dougal, were you feeling a bit frustrated with him? Or
it was earlier than that, actually. I mean, I think it was after about four, I realised he wasn't earning enough to live on.
Yeah.
And so I began doing novelizations and things, and I ghosted a few books.
You did Bergerac, is that right? Did I get that right?
Yeah, Sergeant Jim was very, very good to us.
Yeah, this is I'm sure you all know the series, which is set in which island in the Channel Islands?
Jersey.
Yeah,
and the what happened was I was asked to do a novelization using as a basis three TV scripts, and the creator of the series liked what I'd done, and so when Penguin came to him a year or two later and said, would you write some completely original Bergerac novels for us, he said no, but I know a man who might, and he passed it on to me. So in other words, I could write my own stories, my own storylines, but the one thing I couldn't do is I couldn't change the core characters,
yeah,
or the setting,
yeah,
too much. And I did four of those novels in 8 months, 50,000 words each, and it was incredibly good training. I really learned a lot about the craft of it.
And did it make it easier having that character that you couldn't change, or did it make it frustrating having that character that you couldn't change?
In some ways it made it easier, because you knew... I couldn't make him gay, for example, which would have been really good fun, wouldn't it? I knew he had to stay within very tight lines.
Yeah.
So all the energy went into the mechanics of the plot and the actual writing.
It was
a very tiring 8 months, but they're still earning PLR, believe it or not.
I believe it. And the ghosting, any names we would know?
No.
There were
one or two. I mean, I think the one I remember most was a book called Havoc. The author was a retired mercenary who'd been a paratrooper, and then he'd served as a mercenary in Angola. And he'd written a memoir of his time, which was all shooty bangs and things, and then he'd written some novels, which were all shooty bangs too. And he wanted me, the publisher wanted me to sort of make them into sort of fairly readable novels. And so I had to cast myself into the persona of this sort of hard-bitten ex-para sergeant in the jungles of Angolia, which was again, an interesting exercise. Not one I particularly wanted to repeat. I remember going to visit him in his house in, I think, Aldershot, somewhere like that.
Yeah.
And it was full of sort of weapons of war and sort of macho items. I felt I had to be very careful what I said.
Yes. You know. Yeah.
Very strange.
And did the Lidmouth series, was that when you could start to slow down a little bit, relatively speaking?
I wrote some espionage novels first.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, as you do.
Silly me, I forgot as you did about
in
that
the,
bit.
As you did in the 1980s, but the problem is the third of them came out. This was actually set in East Germany, mainly in East Germany and this country. And the central character was an East German toy salesman, which I thought would be an interesting sort of angle on the espionage novel. But unfortunately, almost the very day it came out, the Berlin Wall came down and the whole bottom fell out of the market for espionage. So, yes, I had a moment of actual real panic in the early 90s. I'd written the espionage novels. I'd more or less written The Last of the Dougals by then. And I'd written one or two psychological standalones, like The Barred Window, which is actually a novel of mine I quite like still. I think it works in a way. You're not meant to have favourites among your own books, but I do quite like that one for some reason. It made no money at all, I need hardly say, but it was... I reached the point in the early 90s when I knew I had to make some radical breakout in a new direction. We had kids then and a mortgage, and it was all... I could make very, very little money. Everything seemed to be going downhill. And in the space of 2 weeks, I came up with four outlines. And I sent to my agent. Two of them were never made. And one of them actually was a good one. One of those I think ought to have been made, but that's another matter. But I keep working on that one. But of the other two, one became the Lidmouth series, and the other became the Roth trilogy.
Wow, that was a productive few
weeks. It was a very good few weeks. And my agent, who's a very, very good agent, went out and sold them to separate publishers. So from the mid-90s, they weren't sold for vast amounts again, unfortunately. Yeah. But even so, I had the security of having not one but two publishers and two very different sorts of novels.
Yeah.
And that was good. That was a nice thing to have. So I could alternate as well, which was
so then you
fun.
Couldn't take it any easier, really. And in fact, was it weird writing two quite different sorts of books, or was that actually quite refreshing?
It's quite refreshing. Yeah. I don't have a problem with that at all. You just change gear somehow. It's a mental thing. I mean, I think each book is a self-contained unit, and in many ways it's quite nice to move on to something very different. I do feel sorry for those writers who are compelled by their publishers very often to write novels in the same series over, you know, just always in that one series, because it must be like writing endless Bergerac novels. It must just get so incredibly boring, because you can't really tinker too much with the core characters, and you're just sort of going on churning out the same. Well, we know, I mean, I'm afraid we all know of series where the books, it's the same book with new names.
Yes.
New names, new settings, isn't it?
Yeah. But you said just a few minutes ago that the more you write, the more you get proficient at the writing, but the ideas are harder to come by. But in fact, you seem to have been, I mean, the Roth trilogy was a brilliant idea. The Lidmouth series continues to be a brilliant idea. But then you came up with even more cracking standalone books, which have actually taken you to a totally different level of success, particularly with The American Boy. Where did The American Boy come from?
I'm just trying to remember. I think it really came from reading Edgar Allan Poe's short stories again. That's where it began. Oh, I remember. Yes, it was that, but... At the time, I met a producer of West End plays, and he said, come to lunch, dear boy, I like your novels, why don't you write me a play? And I said, fine, no problem, as you do. And he said, come up with some ideas. And at the time, I was reading Edgar Allan Poe's short stories, and I happened to read in the introduction he'd spent these 5 years of his childhood in England as a schoolboy, and indeed that he was half English. And suddenly this put a completely new slant on him. I mean, I'm sure many of you know this anyway, but this idea that Poe was partly English, that he'd grown up in England, that it wasn't even Victorian England. It was Jane Austen's England. It was literally possible for the boy Poe to have met Jane Austen in a London street. And that seemed to me an extraordinary collocation, that the two things could... these two authors could meet, physically touch each other in a London street, Hogan say. And I knew I wanted to write about this English Poe. And also I think I quite like the idea of that early 19th century period. I like Jane Austen. Mm. You know, I like that period. It's a very interesting period when England was emerging as a sort of superpower, the one world superpower after Waterloo. It was a weird, mad time, I think, in this country. Mm. And so the setting appealed to me. And so I asked the producer, would he like a play on this subject? And he said, no. But it was one of those ideas. I never wrote any play for him, by the way. But it was one of those ideas that wouldn't go away. And it festered for 8 years or something. And then I had to come up with an idea for HarperCollins after the Roth trilogy. And I just wrote down a page full of notes. And I sent them off to my agent just for her to look at and see what she thought. And without telling me, she sent them off to HarperCollins. And Julia Wisdom loved it. And it's a funny thing, this. I got more money up front from that outline than I'd ever had before. And usually my outlines up to then have been much, much longer, about 10 pages.
And this is just
so I'm wondering if there's an inverse law between the length of the outline and the amount of the advance you get. And whether that's because you have to let publishers think they're part of the creative process. And if you give them only a few ideas about a book, only one or two ideas, their brains get to work and they create something wonderful in their own minds and think, wow, this is going to be great, we must have this. Whereas if you do the 30-page outline, they think, you know, I don't like that, no, boring, boring, boring. We won't have this.
Yeah.
So it's a matter of harnessing the creative power of your publisher. That's the way to make money.
One of the impressive things about that book is that you resist the temptation. I'm okay, thanks. I resist the temptation to make Poe more of a central character. I mean, he is a peripheral character throughout. Was that always in your mind? Well, I know he's important to the plot, but he's not a 5-year-old solving crimes or anything.
No. When I sat down to actually think about the facts and figures of this, I realised that when he left London in 1820, he was, 11 years old. And an 11-year boy sort of crime-busting, it's really not too plausible.
Yeah.
Not in Regency England, or indeed any age. And so I decided I'd have a schoolmaster as the main character. But in a way, that liberated me to use Poe in lots of much more interesting ways. I mean, he is, in fact, the central character in a thematic sense. He's, as the narrator of the book says at some point, he's the pintle on which the whole hinge of the story turns. He's everything is connected by him. And the other thing it allowed me to do was to plunder Poe's adult work, from The Raven to The Pit and the Pendulum to William Wilson, all that stuff, and create things, because we know very, very little really about Poe's childhood years, and create events in my fictional Poe's childhood that could, in a writer's mind, have turned into short stories or poems.
That was wonderful.
In the adult Poe. And that was such good fun. I enjoyed that.
Yeah.
There should be an element of fun about writing, don't you think? An element of play.
Yeah.
And I have it with that.
It's a very atmospheric novel, and obviously it's a historical novel. By then, had you got used to doing your research but not putting too much of that research in? Had you kind of got the hang of that by then, do you think, with the Roth trilogy, which wasn't Victorian in any way, but was earlier?
Yeah, I mean, it went back to 1958 in the end, and Litmus was 1950s. I do hate... I really reflected my own tastes. I don't like the sort of historical novels that have four pages of the author's research into a period and then a little bit of story.
Yeah.
And I don't like the sort of historical novels that you know, like all the Victorian ones that had titles like With Wolfe at Quebec or With Wellington at Waterloo. And you had a boy soldier and you had sort of long histories of all the campaigns as part of the novel. And
yeah.
They were always glorious and you know, the sort of thing. I think it's much... The sort of historical novels I like are the sort that come obliquely at you and that shock you into thinking, my God, we're in another time. And that do so not just in the sort of externals of another time, in the cars and the houses and the smells, but also in the less tangible things like the language. I think language is very often a shortcut to somebody's soul and the soul of a time, of an actual period. It tells you how people think, how they categorize things,
yeah.
How they looked at things.
Yeah.
Think of all the words. Well, I won't go on because we could. I could launch into a long digression. I think it'd be a little boring. And also, most of all, of course, in the sort of psychological baggage that people carry on, you know, around with them, what they think of people, other people, their sort of moral code, and that in the 50s it was very different from what it is now in the early 19th century. It was a quantum leap.
Yes.
And so that I wanted to explore that, and that I think a good historical novel should ideally encapsulate that, and that's the important part
of
it. But it should also be a good story. It should also fulfill what a good novel should do, which is, of course, make the reader want to turn the page.
Yeah. Can we talk a bit about morality and the crime novel?
Given
that, as I understand it, and I think I'm right in saying this, that your father was a clergyman, mm-hmm. did that have an effect on you in terms of relating to morality and the crime novel, or have I got that fact wrong?
I don't know. I mean, he was the one who introduced me to crime.
To crime, I know you said that.
Ironically enough, he wasn't the sort of father who brought religion home with him in a sort of offensive way. I mean, it was always there. It was all, you know, it was part of. In Ely, you know, everything revolved around the cathedral. I was at school
was he
there
linked
until
to
I was 13. Yeah. And we went there sometimes every day because the school I was at had services there. You know, it just was all, everything seemed to meet there.
Yeah.
And inevitably, it permeated the sort of mental climate of the mind. And it even though I'm not a churchgoer now, it never quite goes away. Mm. It's a bit like the Jesuits, you know.
Yeah, they get you early. Yeah.
So one reason I wanted to write the Roth trilogy was to actually confront this and actually also use all this sort of specialist information that I'd acquired from my childhood. That's why I set so much of it in the past. And the 1950s bits are actually very close to what I remembered as a little boy in the 1950s and what my sisters, who are older than me, could tell me, and my parents could tell me of that period in Ely. But also I think I was trying to process all my upbringing, the religious side of my upbringing, and find out what I thought about it. I still don't know, needless to say, but at least I tried. And that helped.
But I assume I'm right in thinking that you don't really then follow the P.D. James notion that all crime novels should be kind of moral tales and good should triumph over evil. I mean, that's clear from your work, but I think
that's a perfectly valid way to do it, and I think she does it brilliantly. I think one of the things I really like about her novels is this sense of a sort of four-square moral universe you're in. You know where you are, and yet she's such a fine writer. It works very, very, very well for her. I tend to operate more in shades of grey, I think, but I do like some sort of a resolution, and even if justice is not done in any formal sense, it's usually done, I think, in some informal sense. I think.
Yes. Yeah. My final question before I invite questions from the audience really is about the American Boy was chosen as a Richard and Judy book, which is the English equivalent of Oprah Winfrey's book club, and you were just awarded the Diamond Dagger, which is for your outstanding contribution to crime fiction. Which of those things are more important to you?
He's a brute, isn't he? Well, I distinguish. I have to say, obviously, the good thing about The American Boy was the money.
Yeah.
Really.
It pumped up yourself, presumably.
Yeah, I mean, it, for that book anyway, and indeed it raised the market value I had for about 6 months, and then it sort of slumped back down again to its usual mediocre level. But it did make some money for a very short time, and that was lovely. On the other hand, it wasn't all pleasurable, which really surprised me. I used to think if I ever had a serious, real bestseller, it would be roses all the way, but in fact it wasn't. I didn't like the way it changed things. It changed the way I felt about writing. It interrupted my own writing. You know, I had much more PR I had to do. It changed the way people reacted to me as well, and I found that very, very unsettling. Really unsettling. So I have to say, if I had to choose, I'd say I'd go for the Diamond Dagger, because that, honestly, that's an honest answer too, because the Diamond Dagger is something you get for a lifetime's work, and it's the judgment of your peers. It's other writers, other crime writers have said, we want this person this year to have the Diamond Dagger, and that is enormously reassuring. And I the party we had the other... other week. I had a great time. That was the best party ever for me.
But was there also, I remember Reg Hill when he got it saying, well, everybody thinks I'm going to die now. I mean, it was that sense that...
Yes. I mean, more than one friend said, well, it's downhill all the way now, isn't it? And I don't know quite what's going to happen next. But if Reg is any guide, you know, I think if anything, he improves. Improves with age. So
yeah,
well, if I can be like him, I'll be more than happy.
Andrew, thank you for your patience with me. Let's invite some questions from the audience. If you've got a question, stick your hand in the air. I should say that whoever asked the best question, which I guess Andrew will know, I'm not supposed to say that. If a guy said that, in fact, just rewind for about a second. Could we have any questions from the audience? Yes. Do you write at considerable speed, and how long does it take you to write a novel, usually?
That's a real writer's question, isn't it? Seriously. One definition of a writer is someone who counts words. I count words all the time. I used to write quite fast, as with the Bergerac or something. I'm slowing down, I think. When I'm actually writing a book, as opposed to planning it or editing it or doing PR or something, I try to write about 6,000 words of first draft a week, that sort of length. I often fail. If I exceed it, I feel very happy. I think the most I ever wrote in a week was when I was about 20 years ago, and I think I did 19,000 words in a week, which is pretty damn good, don't you think?
Well, pretty damn good, yes.
And they were
good
awful,
words.
But,
they were awful, right.
I mean, that's the thing. I think, actually, one thing I have found that as time goes by, I'm more and more choosy about what words I write, and I tend to go over them more.
Yeah.
And whether or not that's a good thing or not, I'm not sure. So, I mean, this book, if I write a book that needs lots of research as well, that always slows things down, because I have to check things. Like the one I'm on now, it seems like I've been on for all eternity, but it's in fact about 18 months, I think. And that's set in the late 18th century. And I don't think I'll ever finish it.
But presumably you are still on the one-a-year conveyor belt.
No. I mean, I ought to be, but I've fallen off.
No, it's good because you are so esteemed.
No, it's not. I'm missing deadlines, and publishers really don't like you when you miss deadlines. It's pretty worrying. It's scary. It's a sign of my complete unprofessional attitude.
I can't believe you've ever been unprofessional. But, I mean, are you enjoying taking a little bit more time?
Yes. I really enjoy researching. I really like being able to think about what I say rather than just have to churn it out as fast as I
can. You are turning into Reg Hill, because remember Reg Hill saying he never wants to finish a novel now. He never wants to hand it over to the publishers.
No, it is very tempting just to keep on going on and on and on. Isn't it?
Okay, there was somebody a couple behind, yes, the lady there, and then we'll come over there and then here.
Well, I mean, this is the scary thing. It's not dead yet, is it? The old monster has got a bit of life in it.
So that was still in the early 60s. Yeah. We still had swastikas around at his house.
And now we have some very peculiar political parties rearing their
heads. And some very peculiar Mosleys. I mean, they've gone a slightly different way since Oswald Max has...
And even some sort of Labour parties and Conservative parties are doing some very peculiar things.
This is absolutely true, yeah. But is there a question as well?
Oh.
Can we shake another Leibniz one out of it?
I really want to write another one. I have a file of notes. I saw the editor the other week, and she wants another one too. I've got to write this book I'm on now, and I've got to write one more novel, which is also in the 18th century and also will be quite a biggie. But once that's out of the way, I'm really, really hoping Leibniz will be next.
Good.
Honestly. I promise you that.
You're a very charming man, but how do you balance the different publishers? How do you keep them all happy?
With difficulty. And in fact, I think I very often fail. It's they really don't like it. Are there any publishers in the room? They really don't like it. They like to feel they own you entirely, but there's absolutely morally no reason why they should.
Absolutely.
And I think it keeps them on their toes, but it can make things a little awkward sometimes.
Yeah. No, I'm sure. There was somebody, yes, there. Yes.
Andrew, a lot of your books have quite a strong sense of place and time, you know, in terms of, you know, what century you're writing in, but you also have some very well-developed characters. Which comes first, the place, the century, or the characters that you then put into that?
That's an interesting question, which I find quite hard to answer. I think it tends to be all three emerge simultaneously. I do like to have a setting, and that's usually a time and a place. And that comes very, very early on. But very often the character will, or the characters, some of the key characters will be there too. If anything, I'd say the setting probably. If anything, but not always.
Do you have that thing then that a place can be a character in the novel? We talk very loosely about, you know, Edinburgh for Rankin is a character in his
novel. Oh, I think with Leibniz, certainly. Yeah. I mean, I think Leibniz is more... It's more than a place. It's a state of mind. It's a whole culture. I think it is a character, really. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Jay, there. Yeah. And then over here. And then over here.
Do you ever use working titles, or do you always have the actual title of the book as you're writing it?
Occasionally, I've had to have a working title, because I know it's not right. I called one of the early Dougal books "Freelance Death," and I hated the title. And I thought, I really don't want this, but it'll do. It's a working title. It sort of sat on my back like a black dog all through the writing of the novel, which was rather harder than usual. It went out still with that title because I couldn't think of another one. It wasn't the right title. You know, I know it wasn't. And I usually have a title by the time I start writing. I much prefer to have one.
I mean, you're very good at titles. Apart from that one, do they tend to kind of come naturally, or do you really have to work at finding a quite striking title?
They tend to come naturally, or my wife runs into my office with one. She came in once saying, "I've just heard something on the radio, A Stain on the Silence. Isn't it a great title?" And I said, "Yes, we'll use it for the next one, shall we?" And I said, where does it come from? And she said, I don't know. But we found out in the end, Samuel Beckett used to say his work...
Oh, really?
...was what enabled him to leave a stain on the silence. He didn't believe in God, he didn't believe in the afterlife, but he thought his work was the one thing that allowed him to leave a stain on the silence. I think it's a lovely phrase.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. There was somebody in this, just before you, did you want a question, or on the second row there? No? Sorry, I thought you had your hand up. In that case, lady there, and then you, sir.
Maybe I should use the current novel as a case study. It's much on my mind at present. I began writing it, I think, in October, November, and I wrote about 40,000 words of it, and something wasn't working. And I reread it, and I fiddled with it, edited it a bit, and I thought, this still isn't working. So I thought, I'll start again. And so I jumped 40,000 words. When I say junk, I mean I did, when I began again, I recycled many of them, and the characters and the settings and all that sort of stuff. So in fact, it wasn't quite as drastic as it sounds, but I had to. I began again afresh. I wrote 80,000 words, and that took me up to April, I think. And I ground to a halt again, and I thought, this isn't working either, it's getting too complicated. This is something I think crime writers are particularly prone to doing. They make plots too complicated. And I'm aware of this in me. I get far too rococo in my plotting. And I thought, I've just got to simplify this. And the only way to do it, really, is to begin again. So I went through everything I'd done on that second draft. And I removed large chunks of it. And I went down from 80,000 to about 60,000 words. You see, I count words. And since then, I began writing again, I think in mid-April, and I had a great spurt. I've now done, I'm nearly up to 90,000 words now, and I'm stuck. So I don't quite know what I'm going to do now. But when I say stuck, it's not really writer's block, it's merely, you can't find your way around a crux in the story. And I know that it's not a block in any psychological sense, it's simply... I've got to find a new way into this. And there always is a new way. Or I have to ignore it. Another way to avoid writer's block is, I think, simply ignore it right on. Say, 3 months' time, you know, sort of leap over it. And very often, what was causing the writer's block will solve itself while you write.
I'm glad your editor is not that person having palpitations at the back of the room there. Yes, sir.
Is there ever a potential concern that when you're writing history like The American Boy, and you filled in the life of Poe, and the young life of Poe, and you have a book which is very popular, that this could become part of people's history and interpretation of Poe in the future? That you have actually made a life for that person that is not written, and people say, well, I read it, I know this, it must be true.
I think that's a very real danger. Not that it worries me too much with Poe, because he relentlessly mythologized his own life. Partly, there's very little materials about his childhood, which is why I suppose a novel might supply the want, but almost seem like fact. But since Poe himself was at it all the time as an adult, I don't see why I should hold back too much. But I do take your point that there is. I mean, I am with that book. I had a long afterword saying exactly what I knew for fact. And what wasn't. So I was aware of that, that could be a problem. It is a good question, though.
Yeah. Another question? No? Well, let me ask a question, which will probably be the final one, about you and your ukulele.
Yes, I thought you'd forgotten that.
No, I hadn't. I was saving it.
Yes. Well, yes. We were chatting lightly, and he prized it out of me. He's very good at prizing things out of me. Yes, in my leisure hours, I play in a little rock ukulele band called The Pukes.
A rock ukulele band.
We are punk. We are punk ukuleles, and we play other instruments as well, not just ukuleles. And I should say, when we play ukuleles, we play them extremely badly. And so that's where the
and
where
you've,
the
but you've just come. Been on a well a one gig tour.
Our first international tour. If only I thought I could have come with a T-shirt and with a ukulele. We've got the T-shirt that says The Pukes, Amsterdam, 2009. It was great, actually. I had a lovely time.
Yeah. I think that's a perfect place to end. The thought of Andrew Taylor with a puke T-shirt on, playing the ukulele, is perfect. He's going to be signing books in the, down the corridor. Well, thank you, Nag. Thank you, Andrew.
Thank you very much, Peter.
Thank you very much.